Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, got a lot of things to discuss, especially since it's earnings season, although banks and pharma companies usually the first to report, as we've seen over the last couple of weeks. But over the past week or so, we've gotten some valuable insight into a variety of retail areas, including pharmaceutical retail with Walgreens. We'll also talk about a notable REITs earnings call, and we'll discuss Carter's earnings to lead off our show. A couple of quick notes here. First, you can always follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. And remember to like and rate us wherever you do access us. The other thing that I wanted to mention is next week, we're very excited. We get a return to the interview segment on the show for those that maybe are just starting to listen to the show. In the past, we had interviews pretty much every week with people in the retail landscape. But because of a position I held with my day job over the last year, we really haven't been able to do interviews on the show. Now the embargo on those is kind of lifting, and so we get our first interviewee next week. Back on the show is Dani Cushions. She's the CMO of Cardlytics. She'll be on to discuss their recent holiday sales trends report. So very much looking forward to that. It's always a good time when we have Dani on the show. Now, the next thing I wanted to mention is something that we won't be talking about on today's show, Amazon's earnings calls, but did just want to note it's kind of interesting. The stock took a pretty big hit because margins were low because, what do you know, one-day shipping costs money, and that's something we've been talking about for a while. It's kind of interesting that the market only now reacting to the fact that Amazon has lower margins than most brick-and-mortar retailers do have. The last thing I do want to note before we get to the news portion, and Leighton, I want to bring you in on this as well, but just past Halloween, we had talked about the fact that a lot of people expected the Halloween shopping season to be a little bit tepid, maybe not up to standards as far as where the rest of retail is headed. But one thing that we noted is a lot more people are now going to grocery stores for things like costumes, for things like accessories. I definitely saw a little bit of that. I went to my local Kroger affiliate day of Halloween at about 3-4 p.m. They were almost completely wiped out of costumes. It was a madhouse in there. Much of the candy was gone in addition. And I know that for both of us, you know, Halloween isn't necessarily the first holiday that we look forward to. I get that, you know, a lot of people are very much into it. Obviously, if you're a child, it's a big holiday for you, and I always enjoy giving out candy with my residents. But what were some of the Halloween trends that you saw in your neck of the woods?
Well, you mentioned a Kroger affiliate trend. I live right next to a Ralph's, which, as most of our listeners may know, is a wholly owned subsidiary of Kroger. The Ralphs did an excellent job in just decorating the store, getting into the theme of Halloween. So you have not only that merchandising aspect that really intrigues customers, makes the kids in awe when they walk into the store, but you did see a lot of cross promotion. So to your point, you saw a lot of candy and foods that were related to the Halloween event overall. There were orange and black colored, but then also you see that there are a lot of costumes, a lot of things, a lot of gadgets, a lot of toys, everything that you could think of that's related to Halloween to get people really psyched for the holiday itself was actually in a grocery store. So in this case, again, Ralph's was doing an excellent job in promoting and trying to drive sales. And I think overall, you're seeing a lot more of that. So not only in grocery stores, but any store. We're talking about maybe an apparel store really trying to take advantage of this particular type of event. Because I think overall, Trent, it really behooves the retailer to get in, and I think social media has a huge part in this too. It behooves them to sort of make everything an event. So if you can draw in traffic somehow, some way, you should really try to pull that trigger. And I think at the end of the day, it really does stem from social media, because if you're a retailer that has a social media presence, Trent, you're going to want to partake. Whether or not you sell Halloween merchandise or not, you're going to want to engage with your immediate audience. And I think that's what a lot of retailers are doing. And I think it's going to drive a lot more sales. I will say, and I don't know if this is entirely retail related, but overall, this is my first year living in Southern California during, you know, the month of October. And everybody was really in the Halloween mood, in my place of work at least. People were dressing up in costumes. There was more candy than I've ever seen in my entire life. It was extremely hard not to indulge. But overall, you see that, well, that merchandise had to come from somewhere. So someone at the end of the day is benefiting from that revenue. So all of that income coming in, customers really excited about what they've seen. The whole idea that the industry is really trying to take advantage of moments like this is a prominent feeling. You see a lot of old Sears outlets that are becoming Spirit Halloweens for a month or two, and incredible to see the transition just for a short period of time.
And speaking of Spirit Halloween, one moved in just down the street from where I live in an old Toys R Us, and my wife actually had to go there again Halloween Eve, but she said the place was basically cleaned out. She saw a lot of progress towards getting all that inventory moved out, which is crucial for those type of stores because any leftover inventory, you know, some of it can cross over to the next year, but a lot of it can't, to be quite frank. So that's a good sign certainly for them. I will say this, though. I went back to that same Kroger affiliate the next day, the day after Halloween, just to pick up a few things. And I noticed that there were a substantial number of Halloween clearances. So that's not a good thing. That always obviously hurts margins. So that's not something that a lot of stores want to see. But one thing, if you've ever worked in retail, especially with the seasonality of retail, you might notice this, but the clearances in this particular store, as they pertain to candy, were limited. And this is because a lot of the candy manufacturers are actually doing something quite smart where they're not putting holiday-specific branding on their candy packages. Instead, you'll see a package of 110 pieces of candy, and it'll have the different brands on it, but nothing Halloween-specific. And that is done by design now, a lot more now than it was 10 to 15 years ago, to keep that candy basically evergreen all the way into the Christmas season, to keep those stores from having to clearance off those Halloween-marked packages. Now, that being said, there was a significant amount of clearance activity. I have to think that a lot of what was being clearanced off still in the stock room when I went on the day of Halloween, because the shelves looked relatively empty then, so it might have been an issue in terms of just getting those shelves restocked. But I will say, a lot less candy on clearance over the last 5 years or so than what you were used to seeing, because those candy companies are kind of changing up their branding mechanisms surrounding their seasonal offerings. Well, we're going to move on from that to, you know, we talked about Halloween being mostly a holiday for younger kids or younger adults, although Leighton saw a number of people dressed up at his workplace, not quite as many at my workplace, to be quite honest, but obviously it's a children's holiday first and foremost. So we're going to lead off the show by talking about children's apparel. And this is actually somewhat unusual for us. We've been talking a lot about apparel in general lately, but specifically children's apparel, which we usually only dive into once every 3 to 4 months on the show. Most notably, about a month ago, we took that dive into the elasticity of pricing a few weeks back and how there may be more headspace for a lot of retailers than what they think to squeeze margins out of children's clothing, with the exception of the shoe category. And like I said, children's apparel returns this week as Carter's reported earnings for their fiscal third quarter.
They have their flagship stores, of course, but also a number of brands in their holdings as well. In fact, a major impairment charge on this earnings call came from their Skip Hop brand, which saw a loss of brand equity stemming from the Toys R Us closures. Thus, the value of its trade name actually decreased, according to Carter's, resulting in this particular impairment charge. As an aside, Trent, the company still maintains that growth in sales has continued for Skip Hop after their acquisition of the brand in 2017. The main store banners include Carter's and Oshkosh B'gosh, and their children's clothing lines include Child of Mine, a big presence at Walmart, by the way, Just One You, which is at Target, and Simple Joys, which you'll see at Amazon for their digital presence. So, when we discuss Carter's earnings and performance, we're not only getting a glimpse into their store performance per se, but the state of children's clothing retail as a whole. So again, not typically something we talk about, but this is going to be the theme for this podcast here, or this story. Children's apparel, how is it doing? And you can see a lot about the brand health or the health of children's clothing within their call details. Now that we've established some background behind Carter's initial operations, let's talk about their numbers. Despite a tepid start to the year, this quarter put Carter's back on track to achieve their 31st consecutive fiscal year of growth, with net sales growth, Trent, of 2% in the quarter. This was largely driven, it seems, by their wholesale work. Retail segment sales did increase slightly by $5 million or 1.1% over last year. As a result of the more slight increase in retail sales than were seen in the wholesale segment, U.S. retail sales now made up around 49.2% of overall company sales in the quarter, down from the traditional numbers of over 50% we've seen in the past. International retail sales, not included in this number, also increased by 0.9% in the third quarter, or 1.9% on a constant currency basis. The sales growth came entirely as a result of net new openings, of which there were 11 in the third quarter. This is also a bit of a change for the retailer, who saw net closures in the first two quarters of the year. Now they have around 845 retail stores in the U.S., 198 in Canada, and 44 in Mexico. That said, comps, which do include e-commerce sales, were down 0.6%. Not always a positive sign here, but it was said that e-commerce sales were up, meaning that brick-and-mortar sales were lacking, and that is not good for their own physical stores. However, sales via other avenues more than made up for any potential struggles in their own stores. During the third quarter, Trent, domestic wholesale sales increased by a strong 3.9%.
And this is one of the reasons why we do talk about Carter's a little bit more than other children's related retailers on the show, is because they do a ton of wholesaling to other outlets. And as you mentioned, domestic wholesale sales increased by a pretty strong 3.9%. And this doesn't mean that necessarily children's clothing sales are strong at this minute in the U.S., but it certainly does mean that they are positioning to be strong, or that other brands, the Walmarts, the Targets, the Amazons of the world, feel as though those sales are going to be strong in the latter portion of the year. Now, these wholesale sales were said to be driven largely by the Carter's branded line itself. Layton talked earlier about some of their other private labels that are specific to major retailers, but in this quarter, it was the Carter's brand carrying this segment to growth. The U.S. wholesale segment made up 37.3% of overall company revenue in the quarter. Again, this is an increase from last year, in part because they're, I wouldn't say struggling, but their internal sales, their direct-to-consumer sales for themselves, just aren't growing at the same rate as what these wholesale sales are growing on for the company. And in part due to the strength in this quarter from all sales, the company now expects full-year revenue growth to come in at 1.5%, right in the middle of their 1% to 2% range guided for at the beginning of the year. Now, one more thing of note, they recorded a benefit of $2.1 million related to favorable recovery in value of China-related inventories. That's a direct quote from the call. That's something we're not hearing a lot of right now, is a favorable benefit recorded due to Chinese goings on. Now, some interesting aspects of the call that we wanted to touch on. The first is just the overall strength of the children's clothing market, as there are mixed signals from children's retail as a whole, and they actually gave kind of mixed signals on the call. So we see these wholesale sales for Carter's going up as time progresses. But the first aspect you really look at when it comes to children's apparel retail is the size of the market. We've talked at length on the podcast about how people are having fewer children as a whole, reducing the market for things like apparel and toys over time. And what seems to have hurt children's retail, not just with apparel, but also with toys, is the fact that higher income families we're seeing not have quite as many kids now. And those in the middle to higher income brackets, and those outside of the age range where these retailers typically see a benefit, so late 20s to early 30s. And we kind of referenced this in that study that we talked about about a month ago about elasticities, that people are waiting longer to have children. This is a double-edged sword, because they're not having as many children according to the birth rates in the U.S. since the Great Recession. But in theory, because they're waiting longer to have children and because they have fewer children, they do have more money to spend when they do procreate. Now, this was echoed to some extent by Carter's on the call, as they said that business was strong through their Target, Walmart, and Amazon partnerships. In fact, these three, along with a fourth unspecified retailer, are likely to hit new highs as far as their wholesale orders from Carter's in this fiscal year. great news for Carter's as far as the company is concerned, because it means as Target, Walmart, and Amazon are growing their sales in these categories, they're doing so in part fueled from Carter's brands. In fact, Carter's CEO Michael Casey said that these retailers are clearly benefiting, that's a quote, clearly benefiting from the Toys R Us and Gymboree closures that had everyone in this retail sector scrambling for that leftover market share. In addition, Carter saw improved price realization in their retail division this quarter. So we're talking about direct-to-consumer sales again here. They needed to launch fewer promotions to move through inventory. So you're seeing a greater markup. You're seeing them move in concert with that price elasticity decline. In addition, they saw fewer clearance and off-price sales as a whole. Now, off-price is a category for them we'll talk about here in a moment. But again, perhaps a sign that people are indeed willing to pay just a bit more on a child-by-child basis, whether that's because the economy's doing well, whether that's because they've got that discretionary income, whether it's because they've waited longer to have children and now they're more mature as far as the workplace is concerned before they have children. Whatever the reason, we are seeing this as a sign that people are willing to pay more on a child-by-child basis. However, Carter's did still underscore the constant negative numbers they're seeing from lower birth rates. And in fact, according to their data, there is a whopping 5% decline year over year in the young children's apparel market as a whole. Now, that being said, it's a testament to Carter's and their ability as an organization to not see a similar decline in their overall sales. But that's not good on the macro level. You've already seen a couple of retailers exit the category. You've seen certain retailers, the likes of Target, Walmart, Amazon, come in, scoop up that market share, but again, still seeing an overall decline in the young children's apparel market as a whole. And again, they're attributing this to a steady decline in annual birth rates since the Great Recession, since 2008. They were quick to point out, however, that their sales have more than doubled over that span. So again, good for them. But they did note recent data showing first a potential stabilization in those birth rates. So you're not seeing birth rates declining in the future, at least according to their data. And then perhaps future improvement in annual birth rates with a peak population of families in their late 20s and early 30s, which is exactly the ones that would be in Carter's wheelhouse. Again, the longer people wait to have children, the more Carter's at least believes they're going to have to spend on their children. Now, at the same time, Carter's was very quick to note market challenges at the current time to having a child. Now, this could mean a number of things. They just referenced it as market challenges on the call. But depending on perspective, the bottom line is that procreating currently is expensive, and you have expenses on a number of different routes. We're not only talking about clothing and toys and food, but other things like medical expenses that are certainly not getting any cheaper, and it's causing people to pause a little bit longer before deciding to have a child, at least again from the data that Carter's is seeing. You wonder too if any type of economic slowdown, not unlike the one we saw in last year's fourth quarter, would bring these future projections downward, given that people seem to be rather skittish about economic factors when planning their lives after 2008 happened. And Leighton, I talk to a lot of people about finances. I talk to a lot of people about the economy on a week-in, week-out basis. And there is a constant concern, even though currently the economy is looking pretty strong, there is a constant concern that a recession could be right around the corner. And you have to think any slight downturn might cause people to put off having children even longer.
As with other clothing retailers, they said that the weather has impacted their sales one way or another. October demand, for example, has been inconsistent in their retail stores. They were clear that sales are better where the weather has cooled. Their wholesale demand is relatively high, with other retailers having to place orders well in advance of any potential variance in the weather. In fact, this week, Trent, I turn on the news, it's going to be freezing now in a multitude of states, but that's going to affect a lot of retailers, not just, of course, apparel retailers. Of note, they mentioned plans for cross-marketing. They did their brands beginning in the first quarter of next year. To this point, they've attempted to differentiate each brand with Oshkosh, more of a playground brand, if you will. However, they are seeking to roll Oshkosh products out in Carter's stores and do likewise with Carter's products in Oshkosh stores. Previously, they wanted about 50% of their stores to be fully co-branded by 2023. They have shifted this plan to a more aggressive pursuit of co-branding, to where they want 80% of their stores to be co-branded by 2021. So trying to push that up there. Indeed, many customers are probably unaware of the brands that operate under the same ownership group, so this cross-marketing certainly won't hurt. It's not like customers of one or the other will be turned away if they see the inclusion of the other brand. Finally, Trent, they are seeking entry to two places some retailers are shunning: outlet malls and traditional malls. Traditional malls being one of our favorite topics on the podcast. They are seeking to take advantage of Gymboree's closures in malls in particular. Currently, Carter's only has 50 mall store locations, not that many. And seeking to expand that reach, they researched around 1,100 potential malls in which to open stores. That's a lot of malls. However, they turned away the idea of several as a result of, and I quote, weak co-tenancy, among other things. And this is the concept that we've talked about before on the podcast, and we'll talk about potentially with the last story where we talk about a prominent REIT. But the idea that if your co-tenants are not bringing in strong traffic or the type of demographic that you would like, why would you then become a tenant yourself? So they settled on 100 locations to seriously consider and hope to open around 20 or so in locations and malls in the next year, with others potentially following that, of course. As far as outlet stores are concerned, they are seeking to shift their approach as far as their standalone stores are concerned, and they're looking to swap out those with co-branded stores and also update their outlet portfolio to reorganize their retail footprint overall. In all, we expect to see slightly positive net new store openings in the next few years, which is good for the retail economy and the local economies that in which they serve, which might be bolstered by a potential increase in birth rates. However, all bets are off when we see another economic downturn and couples in their late 20s and early 30s avoid further procreation. And that is a consideration for this type of retail. What are exactly the birth rates going to be looking like for the next decade or so? I'm sure that's a very, very important figure a number of retailers have been looking at as of late. Amidst prior negativity surrounding their retail business, Walgreens presents earnings before market open on Monday, October 28th, 2019. Trent, we were going to record last weekend, but then decided to wait for this main news story. Walgreens all over the headlines, as they are in the top three in terms of retail pharmacies in the United States. We'd love to cover their earnings calls, not just for the business overall, but of course their retail division. And that's going to be the main story here. And you look, Walgreens has had sort of a tough year. And a lot of this has to do with slowly losing market share to CVS. They did beat analyst expectations, but profitability for this recent quarter is suffering as a result of store closures. We mentioned during their last quarterly call the immense costs expected to be incurred by each store closure, not the least reason being the long-term rental agreements. If you have a 15 or 20-year lease agreement, which is a very, very average lease agreement for a Walgreens or a CVS out there in commercial real estate investment, you'll see that those leases mean that you have to pay, if you exit prematurely, for that 15 or 20-year term, whatever term is remaining on that particular individual lease, you are on the hook for that amount. And so Walgreens potentially having to be on the hook for a lot of money related to those longer term rental agreements. On the call, Trent, this was, by the way, their fiscal fourth quarter. And as before, we'll focus largely on the retail aspects of the call. Overall sales, though, and this is going to include the pharmacy division, the very important pharmacy division that they're slowly losing market share with. By the way, that increased 2.6% on a constant currency basis, as adjusted earnings per share came in at $1.43, which was, by the way, a slight beat on analyst expectations. So it's not all bad for Walgreens. We're here for the retail numbers, though. Again, we're here for the retail numbers. So we had to dig beyond the headlines from the company that stated company making progress on strategic priorities to deliver long-term growth and, I quote, transformational cost management program. So you look, the latter of which pretty much means store closures and other cutbacks. So you have to dig through those headlines to see what they actually mean for the operations side of the company. And despite the scheduled store closures, Walgreens did see a retail pharmacy increase in sales of 2.1% over a year ago, and this was in the United States. Organic sales growth was an even more impressive 2.9%. This excludes the impact from acquired Rite Aid stores in the quarter, which clearly struggled somewhat on the revenue front.
Meanwhile, pharmacy sales were a mind-blowing 75.1% of the U.S. retail division sales in the quarter. You contrast this with just a few years ago, pharmacy was in the high 60s as far as a percentage of revenue. Now, among reasons for this increase in percentage of overall revenue over the last couple of years, higher brand inflation and prescription volume, both mentioned by Walgreens, both of which something we've also seen at Rite Aid and CVS of late. However, they also mentioned a comp sales increase in pharmacy of 5.4% this quarter versus last year's quarter, stemming from a 3.3% increase in scripts filled on a comp basis. So not only are we seeing greater brand inflation, not only are we seeing prescription prices go up ever so slightly, but we're also seeing just a higher number of prescriptions being filled by Walgreens. So this is good in that they are pulling in a number of the increases. We've seen increases on prescriptions filled across the country. Again, as you see that aging boomer population, this is kind of expected to happen. However, market share, which is really the big thing we look at when it comes to Walgreens, because we know everyone is filling more prescriptions, market share continued to fall in their pharmacy division, with their data showing a decrease of 55 basis points from last year. So their overall market share as far as retail pharmacy is concerned was down to 21% in this quarter, as reported by IQVIA. So we can talk about all of these great things as far as they're increasing sales on the pharmacy front, but the reality is they are just not keeping pace with some of their competitors. And some of this decline in market share they attribute to their store optimization program, aka their slate of recent store closures, which continues to erode their market share compared to their largest rival in CVS and other companies like Walmart, as well as the newer mail order entrants into the market. There's always been mail order script services, of course, but we've seen a lot of newer entrants to the market, and it's always talked about how much Amazon may end up taking some market share as time goes on. Haven't done much of that yet, though. As far as front store sales, those took a step back again, with comps decreasing 1.2% in the fourth quarter. Now, they haven't been declining as steadily as they were 2 to 3 years ago. We've seen a little bit more up and down with the front of store sales with Walgreens, including the acquired Rite Aid stores, though. It actually looks even worse. When you fold those Rite Aid stores into the comps, it's a 3.9% decrease in terms of those front store comps. They mentioned some of the more poorly performing stores in the wake of the Rite Aid deal as far as front store sales are concerned. Those stores are being weeded out in their store optimization program, which again makes one wonder why they brokered such a large deal with Rite Aid in the first place. Obviously, going after that script volume was important, but it seems like they took on a lot of dead weight in that deal. They also blamed the de-emphasis of tobacco for their shrinking of their front store sales. They were one of the first retailers to actually raise the age minimum on tobacco sales to 21, regardless of state regulations. Now, finally, selling, general, and administrative expenses declined marginally as a percentage of net sales by 0.1%. This is a good thing. On the positive side, they cited a ton of reduced legal fees now that they're mostly done with the Rite Aid deal. On the negative side, their transformational cost management program, and yes, by the way, this is capitalized in the release as though this is a proper noun, basically, again, tied mostly to store closures, but this hindered SG&A to a tune of a whopping 16.1% negative impact in the quarter. And again, as Leighton mentioned to tip off the show, for those listeners not closely in tune with the retail real estate landscape, Walgreens is notable for signing extremely long leases, as is Rite Aid, which is worth mentioning given the fact that some of those old Rite Aid stores, now the ones ticketed for closure. With long leases come large settlement amounts if Walgreens chooses to close those locations as well. Now, in many cases, Walgreens, as we talked about, they've got leases spanning 20 plus years. And so if you go to close that location, that settlement is going to be costly. And that 20 plus year lifespan on some of these leases, it's well above the traditional retailer average. In fact, generally speaking, the only retailers with longer leases are going to be those grocers. And we'll talk about grocers as it pertains to retail real estate in our last story. But first, Layton, we wanted to go over some of the other details on the call.
Yeah, and some of these details are worth mentioning, very important details that we think need to be highlighted here. Overall, the messaging was consistent with where it has been in the recent calls. Over the last few quarters, we've been covering their continued attempt to reposition their retail locations and health centers and pharmacies first and retail stores second. And I think this is very notable because, of course, we're the Retail Focus podcast. But you look, previously they had been criticized for not really focusing on the retail aspects in their stores, even though, of course, it takes up the majority of their square footage in their larger stores. So that said, they did note a continued push in their partnership with Kroger, so we think there's some positive highlights there. We've discussed how this is an interesting deal from Walgreens' perspective, since their pharmacy, which of course is their main revenue driver, as previously mentioned, is in direct competition with Kroger's pharmacies. Kroger and Walmart, of course, having a massive presence in the United States in their pharmacy division. Be that as it may, they are expanding from a synergistic perspective with 50 more Walgreens locations featuring their Kroger offer and 17 more Kroger locations featuring Walgreens HBA brands. And so by Kroger's offer, they mean a couple of things. One, a Kroger pickup service, and two, a curated grocery assortment under their Kroger Express banner. This assortment is akin to what we've seen from Kroger's freestanding convenience stores or some of their smaller grocery store concept. And I think, Trent, you've likened it in the past to small Dillon's locations in the Midwest. One opened up in Greensburg, Kansas, that was a town that was destroyed by a tornado around 12 years ago. Anyhow, most of these pilot locations are in Tennessee, the Knoxville market in particular. And if you look, this is in theory helpful for Walgreens and Kroger, as it takes back some of the onus off of Walgreens for stock perishables and allows them to piggyback on the stronger Kroger brand when it comes to the grocery aspect. This is pretty self-explanatory. But outside of that, we don't see Walgreens brand strength being enough to really move the needle as far as their HBA offerings in Kroger stores. Kroger has plenty of HBA offerings historically, and their customers have come to expect what they've had in terms of the type of inventory, the type of store assortment. Yet Walgreens is doubling down on their own brand equity with HBA lines as they continue to pour resources into number7beauty.com or no7beauty.com direct-to-consumer website. And you see here, website sales as a whole have been a bit of a bright spot, with digitally initiated sales up 24.9% over the last year, better than the average brick and mortar retailer, and that's for sure. The number 7 brand is a major skincare private label that they've offered for some time now, but the website, again, number7beauty.com, just launched in September. So the site launch was actually accompanied by a national US TV campaign in an effort to drive that traffic. What is interesting is that the site itself is a standalone site rather than being a conduit to Walgreens' site, but for obvious reasons. They don't want to send traffic away. Walgreens' own main site doesn't actually link to the number 7 standalone site, but just their product line offered through Walgreens. Elsewhere in digital, they just partnered this quarter with Wing to explore the world of drone delivery. They are looking to actually leverage this along with their exploration of robot delivery through FedEx in an effort to get products to their customer base more quickly. However, these types of trails are not only speculative, but usually expensive as well. We saw this, and this was pretty obvious, the expense to Amazon over the last earnings call. Drones and robots are not cheap, and they aren't cheap, nor is the technology that comes along with them, Trent. And that's for certain. You think about the software initiatives that Amazon's had to put through over the past several years, and yet you still don't see drones delivering a whole lot of packages, do you?
Now, moving from drones to other in-store developments for Walgreens, They are continuing to focus on the recruitment of physicians and clinical pharmacists to staff locations and turn them into more of a primary care model. One other thing they mentioned on the call, and they were very bullish about this on the call, I got it brought up a number of times, was their new partnership with Jenny Craig. Jenny Craig will have outposts in 100 Walgreens locations by January 2020 for things like wellness and weight loss within stores. Also, Walgreens is partnering with LabCorp. This is also something maybe not to watch now, but at least in the future, to include their facilities in Walgreens stores nationwide. So far, LabCorp has 58 centers inside Walgreens stores, 21 more in just this latest quarter, but both parties want actually exponential growth from that, around 600 in total in just a few years. And this is actually a partnership that we've seen, or a similar partnership that we've seen, have a little bit of traction in terms of Albertsons and Safeway stores integrating some lab companies in those locations as well. So all things to keep an eye on for Walgreens as they start to move away from those front store sales and start to emphasize that primary care model. It's more of a neighborhood healthcare retreat, if you will, than a true retailer. Well, our final story on the Retail Focus podcast, or our final news story that is, comes from one of our favorite REITs to follow, Retail Opportunity Investments Corporation, as they also released earnings on Monday. Now, the earnings came out just after market close on Monday of this week. Once again, when we talk about earnings calls for retail REITs, we aren't so concerned with profit and loss, because in most cases they are turning a profit, as much as trends they are seeing within the retail landscape as far as real estate is concerned. Now, in the case of ROIC, they continued to deliver very high lease rate numbers. This was kind of the headline of their earnings call. They had 97.7% of their portfolio leased as of September 30th. This is now their 21st consecutive quarter with a lease rate above 97%, which really speaks to the strength of their portfolio. The reason we do discuss ROIC a lot on the show is because of this portfolio. Most of their portfolio is on the West Coast, but made up of neighborhood shopping centers rather than malls. So when we discuss this REIT, we're not talking about shopping malls. We're talking more about neighborhood shopping centers, usually with one main anchor, a secondary anchor. Typically, the main anchor is going to be a grocery store of some sort. The vast majority of their portfolio is anchored by grocery. And we feel as though, you know, we can talk about malls all we want on the podcast, but this really gives us a better pulse of the true shape of brick and mortar retail from a real estate perspective. It's easy to read the articles talking about malls struggling and mall real estate struggling, but in reality, retail real estate goes so far beyond that. So we're really here looking at the kind of the everyday retail landscape as far as these shopping centers are concerned. And on that note, they actually saw a 35.7% increase in same space comparative cash rents on new leases during this quarter. What this means is, as retailers are moving out, they're signing new retailers to lease rates that are 35.7% higher than what the old retailers were paying. And on renewals, they signed 58 renewals in the quarter. They saw an 8.7% increase on average on lease rates on those renewals. So that's a retailer whose lease is running out deciding to stay in place. They're actually signing to contracts that are higher. And again, this speaks to what we have been talking about for a couple of years now. Many analysts believe that retailers now have leverage to negotiate lower lease rates. And we've seen it actually discussed in calls from Ascena to Bed Bath & Beyond, among others. But it's clear that in many cases, this leverage for retailers just does not exist. And we hear it spoken to over and over again. We even see it in articles that's like, hey, well, retail on the brick and mortar front might be struggling, so landlords are more willing to cut breaks and cut deals. But we're seeing here on the aggregate that lease rates are actually going up, as are a lot of lease lengths here. So in many cases, this leverage that's being talked about just doesn't exist, particularly in the grocery and value sector, which is where ROIC has their bread and butter. And REITs like them are actually negotiating lease increases in renewals. So it's not just a matter of, hey, we'd like to stay here. Can we stay at the same lease rate? Rates for the same tenant are more often than not going up and not down. Now, some of these renewals are baked in, so they come up every 3 years or every 5 years. Some of these are being manually negotiated. Now, for the second point here, ROIC and similar firms are actually being able right now to backfill empty spots at lease rates over a third higher than previous tenants. So again, when it comes to the everyday retail brick and mortar landscape, again, not talking about malls, not talking about anything like this, if you have a struggling retailer there and you are ROIC or a similar firm, and maybe you have a retailer like Bed Bath & Beyond, although I don't think ROIC actually has a Bed Bath & Beyond in any of their locations, but a real argument could be made that the landlord would actually be better off without that struggling retailer taking up space on an older lease at a lower rate. In some cases, you could very much see a REIT like ROIC saying to this negotiator on behalf of this retail store, hey, it's honestly a good thing if you guys move out because you're not driving that much traffic in the first place. And we can redevelop your space and capitalize about 35% premium above what's taking place on your current lease. And we've seen this very thing happen to multiple Sears locations where splitting or subletting the vacant spaces actually increased the return for the REIT in question. Even Simon, who has struggled to maintain their portfolio quality, has seen success in doing this in a few mall locations. And again, as we see, they've had no issues inking new leases for ROIC. 38 new leases signed in the third quarter alone.
I absolutely love talking commercial real estate investment, Trent. And ROIC is tied in with great commercial real estate investment thesis and just the retail landscape in general. They know when to get into a property and when to exit a property. So they get into a property that's maybe not 100% occupied. They get it fully performing. They maybe increase some rates, get some good tenancy in there, and then they sell or flip the particular building for a profit. I think their overall operation is excellent. They also buy and hold a lot of real estate. You'll see a lot of buildings that they've had for several years now, and they just like to hold on for that cash flow for each individual property if it's performing to their expectation. Now, they also increased their same center cash net operating income for the 31st straight quarter, a 3% increase over the same quarter last year. And for the millionth time, Trent, I'll go ahead and explain to our audience the NOI. So the NOI is the net operating income that comes from a particular property. So it's gross rents, annualized gross rents, all of the tenants in a particular retail complex, minus the property taxes, minus the insurance. And there you have it. That's the operating income for that building and also any expenses. Usually for the purposes of ROIC, a lot of their tenants have to pay all of the fees associated with their own maintenance costs. So for instance, plumbing and lighting, those are taken care of by the tenant. ROIC does not have to contribute to those maintenance costs. Perhaps some of the costs associated with the parking lot lights, things of that nature, when they need replaced, ROIC will put up the funds to fix those. But these properties, by and large, are strictly pass-through investments, which makes ROIC such a great company because it's not management intensive. These are buy and hold properties that don't need a lot of day-to-day treatment. As far as the property turnover is concerned, Trent, it is in line with what we'd expect from a company the size of ROIC. They sold a shopping center, to my previous point about flipping certain properties, in Stockton, California for around $30 million. They have more than one sale that should close in the fourth quarter, bringing in their total properties sold to around four for the year. They own a total of 88 shopping centers in the United States, mostly along the West Coast, so a 5% property turnover is about what we would expect from a company like this. Part of their success in increasing lease rates come from their approach to signing retailers. It is what we would call a barbell approach with long-term leases for the anchors and value retailers such as Dollar Tree and the like, with shorter term leases to destination shop retailers. So a big mix here, but an important mix, and one that has taken a lot of time to manage because they're trying to curate appropriately for each individual center. They're not all alike, so they should be treated differently. As such, their strategy is going to differ from time to time. Ordinarily, this might seem a little bit risky. After all, these destination shop retailers are likely to be both smaller than grocery retail chains, but also more susceptible to macroeconomic shifts, as well as shifts in how people shop. Of course, niche shops are going to be a little bit more seasonal in nature. They're going to be a little more trendy, so they may actually leave prematurely. That is the downside risk for this particular case. However, this is why we felt like this was notable to mention on the podcast. The leases that ROIC is signing with these smaller retailers are the ones going up by leaps and bounds, and yet they still have a very low vacancy rate. So that tells us a couple things, Trent. That tells us that they're actually signing retailers, these niche or smaller retailers that are doing very well for themselves, one. And two, in terms of the overall economy seems to be doing very well, so that these retailers are not exiting these shopping centers prematurely. So we cannot say this enough. Retail, physical retail, is not dying, and most REITs are not struggling to fill their spaces no matter the size. We are seeing significant struggles in C- and D- class shopping malls, but many of these neighborhood shopping centers, like the one that are in ROIC's portfolio, are still progressing and still doing very, very well. Again, I have to repeat what Trent said at the beginning of the story. Over a 97% occupancy rate is excellent. And I think it really speaks to the management of this company, but it also speaks to retail in general. Retailers have smartened up. Both small and large retailers know where they should be and what demographic they serve. And as such, they're being highly profitable as of late. The other thing we should keep in mind is that with these retailers, there is a potential for building out on a lot of the out parcels with a variety of different outlets, including, of course, QSRs, which we used to cover on the Food Focus podcast. But Taco Bell, for instance, is growing throughout the West Coast. Well, they're growing in areas that are driving already a lot of traffic. So they are a retailer or a QSR example of someone who would be looking at an outparcel to develop a new location. So a lot of other smaller retailers too, aside from QSRs. This too is something that ROIC is seeing definite development in, and that is essentially just free money. Whether you're signing a ground lease for a QSR or doing the entire build to suit, I think it's going to be an extremely profitable venture for them to build out open out parcels. Part of the benefit they are reaping, and something we don't talk about often, is the fact that these shopping centers are in established neighborhoods already, making it difficult for other landlords to build new complexes. And this is sort of a theme you hear about. I don't know if a lot of our listeners hear about multifamily development, but in concentrated neighborhoods, for instance, the Los Angeles metropolitan area, if you have an already existing apartment building, it's gone up in value and will continue to do so because the population density is so high. You can't develop an entirely new multifamily complex because there's not a lot of vacant land. So the same thing here applies to these shopping centers, in that once it's already developed and the neighborhood around it is developed, there's not really anywhere you can create a shopping center out of nothing. You would have to pull permits. You would have to do demolition work. You would have to do rezoning activity. All of this is extremely expensive, and it's a really good way for ROIC to protect their own investment by having these types of shopping centers in these certain neighborhoods. This, in turn, gives landlords that own these types of properties a lot more leverage in the long run. And, you know, to be in a part of town that is blanketed with commercial properties as opposed to one that is really thought out is going to be very good for them long term. And it's going to create a sustainable business model for ROIC.
And one other thing I just wanted to kind of tack on to the end of your discussion there, Leighton, is about not only those out parcels, but also, you know, the smaller niche retailers that are re-signing contracts. If one does not re-sign, there's actually other groups of tenants in these type of shopping complexes that are willing to move in. Point in case, the fourth largest tenant for ROIC is JP Morgan Chase. And you might say, well, why is this? Well, they're building on a lot of those out parcels, but they're also backfilling a lot of the older retail locations with banks in these shopping centers. But you look at their personal exposure, this company's exposure at least, to supermarkets, and it's pretty well spread out. Albertsons, Safeway, Kroger, Save Mart, Sprouts, Trader Joe's, H Mart, they've got all of those as tenants throughout multiples of their properties. In addition, they're starting to build on the latest movement to off-price. Marshalls and TJ Maxx are in the top 10 as far as tenants for them, as well as is Rite Aid, who is a company that's been struggling a little bit of late, but we mentioned in the earlier Walgreens story. So it's a matter of diversification, but these neighborhood retailing centers don't get talked about often enough, and that's why we like to bring up ROIC on at least a twice yearly basis on this podcast.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I take a look at a story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. I'll actually go first this week. And a study came out from Adobe Analytics saying that digital sales could increase up to 20% of overall holiday sales this year. That would be a massive jump if those numbers hold. So there's been a lot of talk about digital retailers. We talked briefly about Amazon's earnings call earlier on in the show. There's also a lot of talk about brick and mortar retailers trying to move progressively into digital, trying to utilize app-based sales as well for their customer base. And one company who's done that for a long time is Wayfair. However, one thing that Wayfair has not done, since becoming public at least, is turn to profit. And actually, the margin between profit and loss got even worse in their earnings call this week. Now, this comes off of a fairly solid earnings call about 3 months ago where they actually narrowed that gap between profit and loss to about the tune of $25 million going quarter over quarter there. But progressively, this is their worst quarter since going public in terms of the loss. In fact, their adjusted EBITDA was even negative of $144.2 million, which doesn't even include some of the other aspects that would show up on the overall ledger. So their loss ballooned now to where it's approaching $300 million per quarter. And the CEO is still confident in the future growth of the business. They're still seeing customer growth. The bottom line, though, is they're tremendously unprofitable on this growth. And I think this is kind of the conundrum facing some of these digital pure play or e-commerce pure play retailers is that, yes, is your business growing? Absolutely. You're bringing in much higher percentage of customers than you were 5 to 10 years ago. But the question is, how do you turn that into a profit? Because if on every sale, let's just say on every sale, Wayfair is losing $5, and you bring in more sales, you're just losing more money, whether that be on shipping, which is a big issue for Wayfair because they're shipping these enormously heavy and bulky items all throughout the country. Obviously an issue for Amazon as well, whether that's on shipping, whether that's on necessary markdowns to get people to purchase at your site. But it seems like a race to the bottom in terms of profitability, and you can only go so far and still be unprofitable. Something usually has to pull back. We see this in waves in brick and mortar retail throughout history. You see waves of closures and buyouts. Sometimes these are linked up with recessions, as they were in the early 90s, where you saw a number of closures and buyouts. Sometimes it's not. We saw a wave of closures and buyouts. Leighton and I were talking before the show in the late 90s, just because, you know, models weren't working. There wasn't a recession at that time. It just so happens that the model wasn't necessarily working for that particular company. In the case of the late 90s, you had some catalog companies like the likes of Service Merchandise, who had brick and mortar operations, end up closing down a lot of their stores or tailing back a lot of their stores, eventually declaring bankruptcy and closing down later. So you see these waves there throughout retail history. My looking ahead is there in all likelihood is going to be a wave of either consolidation or closure in the e-commerce space. We talk far too often about this being the case in brick and mortar, but companies like Wayfair can't persevere for decades on end losing $300 million a quarter. So When is this going to happen? And then what is it going to look like? Is there going to be consolidation to the point where there's really just Amazon and a few other very strong players in the online space? Or are we going to see maybe some movement in e-commerce to where these companies can figure out how to squeeze a profit out of things if they consolidate with one another? So that's my looking ahead story. Not really painting a bright picture for the future of e-commerce, but it's been the problem all along, is that a lot of e-commerce retailers, too many in fact, just aren't profitable, and they don't seem to have the pathway to profitability that some of their brick and mortar retail competition has already established.
Such an interesting story, Trent. As much as Wayfair has taken market share in multiple categories away from companies like Bed Bath & Beyond and others, they certainly are not profitable, and that clear pathway to profitability is something that in the short to midterm, investors are going to be scratching their heads saying, where is the strategy here? Where are we going to see our first dollar? We can make money in terms of capital gains, sure, but is the company going to be sustainable for the long term? It's akin to something we've seen recently with Uber and Lyft. Here are these massive companies that have massive network externality globally, yet are wildly unprofitable. Even if you were to shed away their administrative fees and all of the management with R&D processes, it does not matter. They are not a profitable company, and a lot of analysts do not see them being profitable for close to a decade. So same sort of theme there with Wayfair. You can't continue losing tens and hundreds of millions of dollars every year and then expect to be a sustainable business model. But it is interesting to see how they've grown and how really they have gained a lot of momentum in terms of acquiring long-lasting customers, customers that are going there not just for one or two times for when they move into a new apartment, but for maybe a few years, always going there and seeing what's new. So I find that to be very interesting. I'm going to keep it in the digital realm, and I'm going to keep it short this week, Trent. So I'm going to look to Amazon, as a few days ago, they just announced they're going to have their two-hour grocery delivery free. Not for everybody, but of course, for their Prime members. And there's a couple caveats that the news headlines did not catch. And so I think it's important that I mention this on my Looking Ahead segment. This is my Looking Ahead segment to not only disclose the fine print of this offer to the public, but then to also say that, again, we're talking about a company that has had margins that are shrinking in the recent term, and a company that is competing now fiercely with the likes of Target and Walmart for grocery delivery and really convenience in this particular facet of the retail landscape, because people want their groceries, they want them a certain way, and they want them brought to their door within 35 minutes. And it is a very, very tough world to be in, because the expectations are only going to be narrowed in the future, right? So if somebody 2 years ago complained that they could not get their groceries delivered within 24 hours, well, now they're going to complain that they can't get them within 4 hours. And then it's going to be they can't get them within 2 hours. The expectation is always going to be a very short time frame. People are going to want things now, and it has to do with multiple things in society, one being instant gratification with cell phones. But overall, Trent, you're seeing that Amazon is essentially playing with fire here in terms of margin and the fate of their grocery margins, because what they're doing here, what they're proposing, is eliminating the monthly fee. It's around a $15 monthly fee, $14.99 to be exact, is what they've been charging their Prime members who live in, by the way, certain areas. They can get 1 to 2 hour grocery delivery. So if you purchase something from Amazon's web app, let's say Trent decides to buy spinach, he can, if he is a Prime member and he's paying in good standing the $14.99 per month for delivery, he can get via Amazon Fresh his spinach at his door within 2 hours. And Trent, I believe you live about 20 minutes from a Whole Foods, so that is plausible. But on Amazon's website, it also says you have to order around $35 to qualify for that free delivery. That is going to still stand. What is not going to stand is that $14.99 delivery fee. So that monthly fee is going to now go to zero. However, the caveat, and something I had alluded to just a second ago, is that This only pertains to Prime members that have already had an Amazon Fresh account. This does not pertain to members that have decided to sign up for Prime and decided that, oh my gosh, I saw the headline of free delivery within 1 to 2 hours with Amazon Fresh. No, you have to take another step. Not only do you have to sign up and do all the proper signings of the Prime membership and the Amazon Fresh membership, but then you have to request specifically an invitation for the company to alert you when you're able to shop within that particular window. So it's not a guaranteed $0 fee for new Amazon Fresh members. So it's not for everybody, but it is for existing members. And what this means, Trent, and this is what I'll end this story off with, is that Amazon is basically subsidizing, they're internally subsidizing the cost of delivery. Because if you have, let's say, $40 worth of groceries that have already seen a margin reduction because of Whole Foods price reduction initiatives over the past year, then essentially you're looking at, well, how long is it for the delivery driver to get to your home? What's the round trip cost? What's the cost of them walking around the Whole Foods or the fulfillment center to get your items and then to bring them to your home? So those are all factors that you have to take into consideration. And it, let's say you hit the $35 minimum. Let's say, again, it's a $40 delivery of Amazon groceries via Amazon Fresh that you want brought to your home. It is probably $12 to $15 in overhead automatically that Amazon has to spend to get those groceries to your doorstep. On top of that, they're probably only getting a 5 to 6% net margin on the groceries at the MSRP. So you're looking at a net loss for this hypothetical order here. The question is, are people going to spend more than $35 to $40? Or are they going to be spending hundreds of dollars on groceries weekly to have sent to their doorstep? In that case, yes, it could make financial sense for Amazon to initiate a $0 Amazon Fresh monthly fee. That would make sense. But what's interesting, and again, why this is my looking ahead, what does this have to deal in terms of the overall landscape? All of the competitors, what are they going to do to accommodate this fluctuation in the market? Are they going to change their current practices? Target's already reduced prices and made things a little bit more convenient for their customers, especially now that the holiday season is approaching. Are they going to continue those efforts? And if so, because the assumption is that yes, they will, are they going to match these $0 delivery fees? And what is that future going to look like? Is that really going to have an effect on grocery traffic? Because we talk all the time about how grocery traffic is still fairly robust. If everyone has a $0 delivery fee, are people in fact going to stop going to grocery stores? And that is, Trent, my looking ahead for this week.
Yeah, you said you were going to keep it short, but ended up going on for quite some time. But you made some valid points there. And ultimately, I'm going to go on record as saying, I don't know that this move by Amazon is going to create too many ripples. The Kroger affiliates near me already have pretty good delivery deals. And also, you mentioned it, there's an internal markup anyway when you're buying from Amazon or Whole Foods. I can get organic spinach, generally speaking, at my Kroger affiliate for quite a bit cheaper than I can get it at Whole Foods for. So that's going to make up for some of the delivery cost I might be paying my Kroger affiliate to get it in that same 2-hour window. So again, if that were available to me, which it's not because I'm not in one of those areas that Amazon is rolling that out to. So a lot of questions coming up for the grocery industry. I think most of them revolve around profitability. Like I said, it's basically become a race to who can make the least amount of money in groceries. So interesting next 5 to 10 years, I would say, in that landscape. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Again, for Leighton, I'm Trent. We'll be back joined by an interview guest next week. Once again, we'll be talking to Dani Cushion. She's the CMO of Cardlytics. And I hope you have a great 7 days until then.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.